Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Sean Dugan of Channel 11 News here in Anchorage, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Sean, as the election campaign heats up, we see the return of Backbone, the reincarnation of the group Backbone. Mm-hmm. First of all, remind us, who is Backbone and what are they going to try and accomplish at this election season?
Well, Backbone was originally started by former governors Wally Hickle. Jay Hammond had a part in it, and it was made to encourage Alaskans to stand up and get their fair share of the money that comes out of the ground with the oil companies. So it's back, and its purpose is to save the Senate bipartisan majority. As you know, there's a 10-10 tie currently in the state Senate, and there is a bipartisan majority run by 10 Democrats, 6 Republicans. With redistricting, the GOP party at least is hoping that they're going to pick up some seats and break that deadlock. Why is that deadlock important? Well, the governor at least blames that bipartisan majority for stopping his changes to Alaska's clear and equitable share, the oil tax structure. He wanted to lessen the take at high prices. Backbone claims that's a $2 billion giveaway. The governor and the Alaska GOP party have both said that they are going to work to bust up the bipartisan coalition. Now, I talked to Randy Riedrich yesterday, who is the outgoing longtime Alaska Republican chair, and asked him if there was going to be a litmus test in the general election for state Republicans, especially in the Senate, of whether they supported the governor's plan to change the oil taxes. And he wouldn't really answer the question. He said that would be one of many concerns or considerations. But he basically said that the state is mostly Republican, so it's time that the Senate reflect that. So,
well, here's what I went to the press conference that Backbone mm-hmm. had on Thursday, and one of the things that struck me is they're not going to raise money. They're not going to interject themselves into individual campaigns. So I guess what they're left with is moral suasion, the power of history.
Well, and they do have a little money. I mean, they've talked about doing some advertising issue based on oil taxes over the campaign. And interestingly enough, the Backbone group is set up to support the Senate majority, and none of the Republican members of that majority showed up. It was
all Democrats
yesterday. And some of those Republicans may be peeling off already. We've tried to get several calls to Senator Lisa McGuire, who during the last session seemed like a critic of some of the ideas to change the oil taxes. And now she's saying that the only backbone she needs is the Republican Party. So it's difficult to tell. It could just be a dynamic that the Republicans in the Senate realize that the writing's on the wall, and they are likely, because of redistricting, to pick up some seats potentially, and then they'll have to deal with their own party.
Okay, thank you, Sean. Dermot Cole, is Backbone strictly an Anchorage phenomenon, or is it going to have resonance and some authority in Fairbanks? Dermot's not with us, apparently.
He's thinking very,
Michael,
very hard.
It will have... The sound is a little messed up here, but
go ahead.
I think that what's more important probably than the arrival or reappearance of a Backbone will be these individual contests. I'm not sure it will have a great impact. The races here will be a pretty sharp contrast, really. We're going to have Senator John Coghill probably against Senator Joe Thomas. And in one of the other key races, it'll be Senator Joe Pascavan against former Senator Pete Kelly. Now, Backbone probably will play a role in terms of getting attention. But you have 4 strong personalities that will be more of, I don't think it's going to be the key factor.
Okay, thank you very much. Jill, oil prices have subsided, Jill Burke, and this has serious implications for the state of Alaska. You've been working on the decline in oil prices, although they're not nearly as steep as they could be. But give us some indication here of what's been happening and what we might expect.
Well, we saw in June, just as the approach of the end of the fiscal year was coming, a dip below the $100 per barrel mark, which was the first time in a year that we had seen prices drop that low. it's a concern for the state because we, of course, derive so much of our state revenue from the oil industry. We like to have the prices high. State government makes more money. You know, we have more money to spend. As the fiscal year drew to a close, prices were at a low of about just below $93 per barrel, which is $17 per barrel lower than what the state had placed as its average right. needed per barrel amount for its 2013 budget. That's significant, in addition to the fact that it had also projected a production decline for 2013. So you kind of have these two issues. One, lower prices, lower production means a lot less revenue for the state. And in fact, the surplus for 2013 was projected to be only a quarter of the surplus that we saw in 2012. So you know, these factors combined are troubling. It's not time yet to sound the alarm. When we spoke to the state financial experts at the end of June, kind of early part of July, you know, it's worrisome, they're watching it, but it's not the sky is falling. And one thing that I think was important to note is they offered an example of, if you have, you know, several months of higher than needed prices, you can afford to have several months of lower than needed prices and still have your budget average out. This month, we're starting to see an uptick in the prices. They are again climbing. They've been flirting around our sweet spot. Right now, I believe they're at $105, $106 per barrel. I think we saw $108 per barrel earlier in the month. So we're on track. The question is, how long will that last? Is the downward trend a longer lasting trend or a typical cyclical dip? Are the European financial markets going to rebound and regain some strength? We also saw an injection of oil from Saudi Arabia last month, which created more available oil on the market. And we have large reserves in the United States, which also contributes to availability and value. So it's always a wild ride. I mean, I think that's whenever I talk to folks at the state, it's always a wild ride. And I think one person told me, you just catch the tail of the tiger and hang on.
Okay, a couple of things worth pointing out here. The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation recently released a report on the Anchorage economy and Alaska as well, and they estimated that for the next year oil will stay at about $110. That's probably consistent pretty much with the state. Mm-hmm. The other thing is I recently heard Tony Knowles give a presentation or a brief speech, and he pointed out that in the 87-88 period there was there was some time when oil was selling for $3 a barrel. And I thought to myself, how could I possibly have forgotten that? But I mean, what I remember, and many people here remember, is that King Salmon was worth the same price as a barrel of oil, but that ought to be a cautionary tale, a big cautionary tale.
Well, and I'll just add one more thing. You know, we have good savings in the state. I think we have nearly $15 billion going into 2013. We don't like to tap into those reserves.
And that's the budget reserve fund.
The constitutional budget reserve. We have other factors which are going to continue to escalate the cost of state government. You have the cost of health care. You have the cost of, you know, labor costs with employees. And those are not on a downward trend. They will continue to go up. So the gap between declining revenues, declining production, potentially declining value, and increasing costs to just maintain your status quo is going to be a problem. I mean, that's a challenge.
Okay, thank you. Dermot Cole, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board switches locations, or maybe more to the point, it has its location switched by the Alaska State Legislature. It used to be under public safety, now it's moving to commerce. Why, and what do the advocates of this move hope to accomplish?
Well, Michael, on the last day of the legislative session, the legislature approved a bill that to move the alcohol toward from the Department of Public Safety to the Department of Commerce. This was the top priority of CHAR, the lobby group that represents bars, liquor stores, restaurants, and really the alcohol industry in Alaska. CHAR's made this is one of their top priorities because they felt the organization has claimed that the Department of Public Safety was too heavy-handed in the enforcement of liquor laws, in particular the sting operations or compliance checks, as the department, as the ABC board refers to them, to determine if bars and liquor stores are selling to underage people. I wrote about this just because it took effect at the beginning of July, and I was also struck by how quickly it moved through the Senate. It was all in one day, really. Senate approved in the House earlier, but the Senate dealt with it for a total of about 23 or 24 minutes in committees and on the floor on the last day of the session. And I raised some questions about that. And the CHAR believes now this will be, says there are some people who believe this will be reduced enforcement. Others say that that's not the case. The Parnell administration has said that the same level of enforcement will continue. CHAR has also advocated for more educational work from the ABC board, but it has it's hard to see with a staff of 11 how really they will really change that much.
This is a very interesting example of a heavily regulated or significantly regulated industry responding to those pressures by going to the legislature, asking for help, and getting it. Jill, former Republican Senate nominee Joe Miller has a new occupation. He's decided, or at least partial occupation, part-time occupation, he's decided, if I'm not going to be a senator, maybe I could be a publisher.
Right. And I don't know that he's not going to attempt to be a senator or some other politician again in the future here. But for the meantime, he has rebranded his former campaign website, joemiller.us, into a conservative online news publication. And that was rolled out on the 4th of July, Independence Day. He announced the change that has a different look to it. When you go to the home page, it shows, I think it says Restoring Liberty with a picture of Joe Miller, and it says Joe Miller Publisher. And he's taking on that role. And you can, when you read about why he has chosen to do this, he said he felt that there was a void in straight news and news that would respond to the interests of his conservative followers.
Let me ask you this. You work for the Alaska Dispatch, which is an online publication. I mean, clearly you understand how difficult it is to publish online, to get viewers, to maintain them in a highly competitive world. How does he do that?
I don't know. I mean, I think that he may not know. I mean, he's right now they are taking a lot of content from other sources, other kind of wire
that's kind
style
of classic
surfaces.
Too.
Yeah, aggregation, a couple of paragraphs and then a link. I don't know how long he'll continue to do that, but he's doing that. And he's got some multimedia content. And then both he and his wife, Kathleen Miller, are authoring columns from time to time for the publication. So she has something called Kathleen's Corner, which I think I've only read one or two of them, but they've been sweet, very personable types of entries. He is generally always focused on kind of critical analysis of what's happening in the nation, his belief that a return to conservative principles and constitutional conservative principles are really what needs to happen, and kind of pointing out a lot of what he believes are missteps by the Obama administration.
Well, and Mike, if I could jump in here, if you don't mind, I think that he's frankly going to have an easier time of making money than maybe a straight news organization
right.
like the Dispatch, because he's going to be catering to the people that are already on his side, and they tend to kind of eat that stuff up. So he has kind of a captive audience already. It's not like he's going to try and go out and maybe influence Democrats and independents. It seems like this is kind of geared toward the people that are already in his camp. So
it would seem to me also it's kind of classic with political figures. They don't necessarily like this Dispatch or the Anchorage Daily News. They're not worried about it paying for itself. They sort of, if they get the viewers and it loses
right.
some
well,
money.
They get donations too. So
here's where Miller's blended worlds come in for me. We have the online publication, the news site, but we also have him rolling over his campaign money into a new campaign account with the federal government called Citizens for Joe Miller. He hasn't declared a future office yet, but the title would imply that he's thinking about it or he would like the option. And there is also a tab on joemiller.us for Restoring Liberty, which is the name that he's used to brand the publication, and also happens to be the name of state and federal political action committees that he established after his loss to Senator Murkowski. There's a fundraising tab and asks you to donate money. And there are also areas on his website that encourage advertisers to advertise on the site. So I'm not really sure what the ultimate end goal is, if there is one. he said it's to fill this news void. Meanwhile, I mean, it's obvious that he has ongoing political intent, whether it's as his own candidate or influencing other races.
Yeah, this is really interesting, that the merging, and I suspect there are a number of these former candidates or potential candidates all over the country who do similar kinds of things, mm-hmm. and especially when you get fundraising.
Yeah, and if you don't like what the media is saying, you just
become the media.
Become the media.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Jill Burke, Sean Dugan, and Dermot Cole. Sean, Don Young surprises a lot of people, especially a lot of Alaskan Republicans, as he weighs in the Republican, or rather the U.S. Senate race in Hawaii, and to the surprise of many, he picks the Democrat.
He does, and you say to the surprise of many, and it's been my experience with Don Young that really nothing should be surprising with our congressman. I mean, he is, you know, he's been, his voting record is extremely conservative, but he's never been a guy afraid to take a flyer on his own. Why he's chosen to support a Democrat in a primary race in Hawaii, it's not really clear. He's supporting Mazie Hirono. She's a Democrat, and she's, by the way, leading in the polls, versus the former Hawaiian governor, a Republican, of Linda Langle. Now, I talked to Randy Riedrich about this yesterday as well because I was over there, and his comment was that Don Young is barely a Republican, and I found that kind of interesting because it's the first time I've ever heard anybody accuse Congressman Young of not being dyed-in-the-wool Republican. It certainly has raised some serious ire among his among the Republican Party in Alaska, but again, Don Young hasn't really cared about that throughout his career either. I'm interested to see how this
and
one works
out. And
if
we were looking at the tea leaves here, we might look into the bottom of our cup and see the face of Daniel Inouye emerging.
Yes.
Absolutely. There's been a long-standing relationship between Hawaii and Alaska senators. Daniel Inouye, as you mentioned, was basically best friends, brothers with Ted Stevens, they called themselves. And so, you know, Don Young's the kind of guy, though, that he takes personal relationships seriously, and I don't know if he has one with Ms.
But she's a member of the House, and of the U.S. House, and has been for several terms. And if nothing else, you can see that they hit it off. Jill? You want to add something?
Oh, no, I was going to raise that exact point, that we do have a template, if you will, in terms of those affiliations, those across the aisle affiliations.
Okay. All right, let's return to Dermot Cole. Dermot, a study shows Fairbanks is paying twice the national average for its utilities. Many people in Fairbanks want to know why, but even more to the point, they want to know what can be done about it. What does this study really tell us?
All right, Mike, we are having a bit of communications problems here, but energy issues, utility issues here, cost utilities, is probably the number one issue in Fairbanks this year, and it will be the top issue in the 2012 campaign. That study, if anything, maybe underestimated the cost of utilities. When you add electricity and the cost of space heating, it is taking a serious toll on the economy of not just Fairbanks, but all of interior Alaska. The price of oil is the main culprit here, and we have an electric utility that is heavily dependent on oil-fired generation. And for space heat, fuel oil is the major fuel. It's not natural gas. And again, with electricity, coal is of secondary importance in many ways right now compared to oil. So this dependence on oil, which is benefiting the state treasury, is causing a big problem throughout the interior. And, you know, everywhere you go in this community and in this region, everywhere you go, this is the top issue. There's no real immediate relief in sight. But everyone is talking about it, and there's, you know, different ideas as to what to do about it.
Okay, and all of them would take quite a bit of time. I was just in Fairbanks last weekend. I was talking to a friend of mine who had just purchased 1,000 gallons of heating oil for the winter. He paid $3.49 a gallon, which is, you're writing a check for almost $3,500. So that really illustrates the kind of question that Dermot, or the issues Dermot is raising, and particularly for the utilities, which, as Dermot indicated, we'll say repeatedly, you have to understand we're not gouging anybody here. We have to pay to get these to get our boilers working, and this is how we do it: through we get them going through oil. Jill, there's a salmon shortage in the bush. We've heard all about that from many different sources. But do we know why? And there's the classic question, what is to be done? And I understand in Caltag, there's at least one person who has some innovative approach.
There is. So there's a king salmon shortage across the state. And it's a problem. It's a big enough problem that the governor has declared a disaster. The governor has also committed more funds to study what's going wrong. There's some thinking that it is a marine environment problem. There are people within the fishing industry who will say that it's a bycatch problem, that large high seas fishermen are scooping up too many of these as incidental catch when they're going for other species. Regardless of what it is, it's here. It's a problem. We're not getting enough kings into the river, into the spawning grounds, and that run has been on decline for some time. We also have other species of salmon which are returning. We have a strong run of reds in the Kenai. We have strong run of chums up the Yukon, and that's good news. The problem for managers and for harvesters, whether it's personal use or commercial use, is that the king salmon and these other abundant species travel at the same time. They have overlapping commuter patterns. So the state is charged with conserving the kings, making sure that enough of them get up, or as many as can if they know they're not going to get enough of them up, and also trying to make sure that if there's a harvestable surplus of the other species, that people have access to it. And that's where you bring in fish politics, which are always messy. They're different region by region. Everybody has a different opinion about what is the best way to proceed. Everybody in the heat of the moment gets frustrated when they just need access to the fish, either to earn money or to stock up for the winter, and they're being told they can't fish. So we have a unique situation in Caltag, which is in the middle of the Yukon, where the king salmon fish, they're bound for Canada, swim on one side of the river. The chum are coming up on another side of the river. And this fish processor that's there petitioned and lobbied and finally got permission to stay open all season long with fish wheels. And the reason is fish wheels, they have shown, can operate. If they scoop up an incidental king, they can return it to the river unharmed. So two factors. One, the large run of kings was on the other side, and if they were getting an occasional king, they could return it to the water alive and keep going. The reason this is significant for this processor is they needed the full summer window, they said, to make their operation economical.
Work, yeah.
Otherwise, just going out for a week, 2 weeks, doesn't work. They're a success story right now. They think for the first time in almost 5 years of trying to revive this fishery that they are going to break even. They have put what they believe is the entire community to work. We spoke to the mayor who said this kind of emotional depression that falls over the community when families can't provide for themselves or their children has lifted somewhat. It's not the same as year-round work. It's not incredibly high-paying work. I think they're making $10 an hour for basic labor, more if you're working overtime. But it's work, and it's pulling in laborers from surrounding communities. And they're very, very excited about it. And they're excited about the possibility for capacity building. So this concept of what are different ways we can fish? Can we use different size nets? Can we fish different parts of the river? Can we use fish wheels? Maybe we use dip nets. Maybe we use different strategies are being looked at other places on the river and also in the Kenai. And it's a work in progress. Works in progress don't always make everybody happy who just needs something now. But
thank you, Jill. Dermot, the voters come election day in the primary election. Just in a few weeks, we'll go through the ballot booths and find us two ballot propositions before them, one of which has been almost undiscussed. What is ballot proposition number one, and why is it on the ballot?
Well, this really originated in Fairbanks some years ago as an effort to try to increase the residential property tax exemption. The legislature has been reluctant to substantially increase that exemption. It is now in many parts of the state $20,000. The measure on the ballot would allow that to be increased the exemption level to $50,000 with local voter approval. This measure made it on the ballot through a petition drive a couple of years ago. And you're right, Mike, it has received almost no coverage recently in Fairbanks and almost no coverage anywhere across the state. since it was launched. We're going to try to do something about that, you know, to write a little bit about it in the next couple weeks. It seems fairly innocuous.
Who would be the main beneficiaries of this?
The main beneficiaries would be homeowners. And, you know, for that reason, it will probably receive quite a bit of support. The counter argument against this is that it's really a transfer and a tax increase on business. Because if you provide a greater property tax exemption for homes, and you still need to collect the same amount of money, you're going to, in essence, be collecting more from businesses.
And so I suppose it's impossible to have a fiscal note because you don't know how many communities might do this.
Right, it can vary from community to community. But I mean, probably one of the important things here is that since this will be determined by local voters, that's really, this is a matter of local control.
And what has to be determined here is we're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us here on Alaska Edition. Nice job, Eric.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.